Okay, I am here with Antonio Aiello, who is in town for the International Festival of Arts and Ideas, specifically on a panel relating to the intersection or maybe the collision between the arts and politics. He is a writer and designer. So first of all, welcome and thank you for taking the time.
Thanks.
And maybe just as a start, if you could just give us a thumbnail sketch of the work that you're doing, kind of where you are in your career, the kind of work that you do, and then from there launch into your own thinking on these kind of broad questions having to do with politics and the arts.
Okay. I guess where I am in my career, I'm the content director for Pan American Center, which is the largest, most active branch of International Pen, which has 140 centers around the world. And the mission, well, it was created in 1921, and the mission is basically to defend free expression and advocate on behalf of writers and to celebrate literature. And what I do at Pen, especially at Pen American Center, is I try and communicate and articulate the various different elements of Pen's programming to a broader, you know, online and international audience, and also to our membership. So I run several series, literary series, poetry series, fiction, interview, a new illustrated series that features graphic narratives from around the world. I also produce several short films every year that highlight some of our more prominent advocacy cases, some of the campaigns that we do. I run our website and social media platforms, and pretty much most of the communications elements of what Pen does. And that's just really, over the last probably decade, just a lot of communications, a lot of reaching out through different platforms to our audience. Mm-hmm. What I do at work with Pen and what I do with my own writing are two somewhat separate elements. I do a lot of fiction and nonfiction where I explore, I guess, the intersection of personal storytelling with imagination. I think working at Pen, I've learned a lot about, I've had the chance to work with a lot of different writers, especially some of the world's foremost thinkers. We host an international literary festival, so every year I get to meet with and talk about literature and art and politics and advocacy with a lot of different writers and hear their different backgrounds and perspectives. And I think it's really given me a much more nuanced look at how art plays a role in our lives, from kind of like a very personal level to a broader, I guess, policy and diplomatic areas, which I'm beginning to have somewhat conflicted feelings about. But, yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm interested in those conflicted feelings. We can get to that. But I know, I mean, obviously in the last year, the case that has overwhelmed the public imagination is the Charlie Hebdo,
right.
And I know that you've probably spent more time than you ever wanted to talking and thinking about that. But before we get to that, I'm curious about some of the other advocacy cases that really don't rise to the level of public awareness so much.
Right. I mean, it runs the gamut. So one of the more frustrating issue or elements was, you know, at the same event where we honored Charlie Hebdo, we also honored Khadija Ismailova, who's an Azerbaijani journalist who is probably one of the most fiercest, kind of like down and dirty investigative reporters working in Azerbaijan, and she uncovered and really reported on some of the most gross corruption cases in Azerbaijan that, you know, led to the highest levels of Azerbaijani government. She was arrested in 2014 and on some very spurious charges, and since then the government has, you know, taken a different tack, constantly trying to bring up new charges with her. She's in jail, and the whole point was to keep her in jail before the European Games, because that's Azerbaijan's way of really kind of entering the world stage on a very strong and legitimate foothold. Lady Gaga sang a John Lennon song, I think it was Imagine, maybe it wasn't, but at the opening ceremony of the European Games. And so for me, having that, her case, which was a very important issue to be talking about that had a very personal implication. Oh. Okay. That really could have had a profound impact on somebody's life now, as opposed to honoring and talking a lot about very superficial ideas of free expression that I think everyone talking about Charlie Hebdo just kind of agreed on, but people wanted to talk about it, was frustrating. So that was Khadija is one case. The Bangladeshi bloggers who have been hacked to death, I think there are three as of today or as of date. There's the plight of Syrian artists and writers, displacement refugees in Syria. We also have 42 writers who are in prison in China. One of them, Wu Jiabo, is serving an 11-year sentence. He's the, 2010 Nobel Peace Prize winner. He was charged he was sentenced to 11 years for writing basically seven sentences, seven of those from his writings, but also most importantly from Charter 08, which is kind of a manifesto, asking for and demanding fundamental civil rights and human rights in China. There's also Ilham Todi, who's a Uyghur academic and blogger who started a Uyghur website, who is now serving life in prison. He was arrested last year and tried in China. And I mean, the list goes on and on. I mean, there's so many people that we're on whose behalf we're advocating for, and they, it runs, across all regions and all countries. And even in the United States, there are many issues that are going on, in particular with surveillance, in particular with like the framing of current issues that seem to be taking place in the media. We did a report on Ferguson and some of the crackdown on media that was trying to cover the Ferguson incident last year. I mean, so there's a lot going on outside of Charlie Hebdo, which was kind of interesting that people really wanted to focus on Charlie Hebdo, because there's so many very important...
Is that because... Well, I'm curious about your own understanding of that whole case, but the notoriety of it, is it just because it was such an easy platform for people to make points that they wanted to make anyway?
I mean, to me, at the end, it seemed like every somewhat privileged male writer had something to say about Charlie Hebdo. And it was, people who wanted to come out and kind of, it started with when Salman Rushdie tweeted saying that the six dissenters were pussies or something to that effect. I don't know what it was verbatim. But that kind of opened the floodgates. It kind of allowed people to take a look at this issue in particular and say, really, people should have the right to say anything at any time, because that's what freedom of expression is, and that if you can't support that, then you don't really stand for free expression. And it kind of it's a very fundamental idea and notion, and it's one that Penn is founded on. I mean, in a much more complicated sense, Penn, one of the free expression to us is it's the fundamental right upon which all other rights are founded. Without the ability to express yourself, and I don't mean in the sense to talk freely, to say, one thing from myself, to be able to say it in any capacity, but it's for other people to hear it, for me to write it, for other people to read it, for us to perform it, for other people to see the performance. It's a mutual, it's an exchange of, free and open exchange of ideas. And that's the fundamental building block of, I think, a civil society, and also of other human rights. If you don't have the right to criticize government or to comment on something, then you don't really have the building blocks to actually create a civil society. So, that was, I think, at the heart of it. And I think all the writers who were talking about and writing about Charlie Hebdo, that's what they were so anxiously trying to say, is that freedom of expression, there are no compromises with freedom of expression. And they kept doing this over and over and over again. And I think where it got derailed is that people stopped talking about kind of the more nuanced issues of free expression. Maybe that the reason why so many people, there was a conflict, and I think there was many of the writers that I spoke to were writers of color, Arab American writers who don't enjoy the same privileged position that maybe the Charlie Hebdo staff does, that maybe the French intelligentsia share. I mean, so they were coming at it not from necessarily like, yes, we all should have the right to free expression. They were coming at it from saying, maybe we all don't enjoy the initial starting point of free expression. And I think that's what was ultimately lost in the discussion about free expression with Charlie Hebdo, and that one that hopefully at Penn will be able to reignite in the ensuing months, to go back and readdress what it is that we're trying to do. And I think that's a particularly important issue to talk about now, especially given the Charleston massacre and the framing of that. If you look at how the news media, you know, frames violence against African Americans or minorities, one of the first things they usually do is they try and go through the background of the victims, looking for justification for the actions.
Right.
And so, I mean, they're very like basic, fundamental, you know, points that we start from, that we, as kind of like socioeconomic affluent people of privilege, take for granted on a daily basis, that other people don't have the chance to. And that's, we're at a disadvantage, or they're at a disadvantage. And I think that's something that needs to be addressed very critically. And it's not, I mean, it's free expression, but it's, we're not at the same point.
Right. Well, it's interesting because to me, one of the things that got lost in that whole whirlwind of debate was, you know, I agree with everything you're saying about free expression being the building block of civil society, but civil society itself is a conception that already implies a certain kind of responsibility.
Sure.
And the responsibility piece of it just dropped out entirely, as far as I could tell. We all have the right to say anything ever into, you know...
Right, into the void. And I think, I mean, one of the things... All right, so with Charlie Hebdo, you know, as the debate, you know, went along, I think... there were some misconceptions about Charlie Hebdo, and I think this brings up other issues that people aren't necessarily talking about. You know, what's the responsibility of the writer or the artist or of civil society in an age when information can be so instantaneously disseminated across many platforms, across such large geographic expanses, that it's immediately ripped from its context? So what, you know, what happens when a Charlie Hebdo cartoon, and, you know, the one of the primary examples of how it was racist was it showed the Ministry of Justice as a baboon, and people said that was, you know, one very primary instance of Charlie Hebdo, you know, creating racist cartoons because she was of African descent. Two things about that. It wasn't a cover cartoon. It was an illustration that appeared somewhere, and so there was already one step of misinformation. But I totally missed my where I was going with that. There were a couple of things wrong with that particular instance. But I'll have to go back to that. But I think what was strange about it was that well, that cartoon was a satirical reference that played into, and she ended up, you know, referencing herself. And I don't think she wasn't offended by that particular cartoon. But Charlie Hebdo, I don't even know where I was going with this. But I guess with the Charlie Hebdo stuff, it was pulled from the French intellectual context. And I guess there was something very strange that happened. And I think one of the things that we all learned is that those cartoons proliferated. So the cartoons, the cover illustrations of Mohammed, that particular cartoon of the Ministry of Justice, they were kind of splattered all over the internet. They were commented on, they were referred to as racist. And, you know, pulled from their context, pulled from the context of within Charlie Hebdo, the publication, without having the background of you know, French culture and society, they did come off as racist. And I think even the staff at Charlie Hebdo would be like, yeah, if you pull them from their context, they're going to be racist cartoons. They are, you know, but they're meant to be within the context. They're meant to be seen and viewed and read and experienced within the experience of Charlie Hebdo, not pulled from their context. But for Americans to come at it and then, you know, want to comment on Charlie Hebdo, and then use it as a, you know, Penn honored it, you know, Penn made the decision to honor Charlie Hebdo for its own reasons. But then you had writers using that as an example for an instance of how you need to defend free expression at any cost, regardless of, you know, the repercussions of those cartoons, regardless of what was discussed. And it goes back to your, you know, your responsibility. What happens to the responsibility of setting the context? And I think that it was something that was pretty strange. People learned a lot about Charlie Hebdo, you know, for better or for worse. And I think, you know, Dominique Sopo came out, who's the director of SOS Racisme, and we learned a lot that, you know, a publication that I think they had a circulation of 20,000, you know, it's not even as big as The Onion.
Right.
It's not necessarily racist magazine. It's not necessarily, I think, it's questionable, it's dubious, they do a lot of objectionable things, but is it fundamentally a racist magazine? I don't think it is, and I think that was probably a misstep by the people who were trying to comment on Charlie Hebdo and Penn giving the award, because it was one of those things where you could go through and you could probably do the research, and people did do the research. They did look at Charlie Hebdo. They read Charlie Hebdo magazines. They talked to the editors. They talked to other French intellectuals or people in France who actually kind of discounted the notion that it really was a racist. But again, for the Muslim minority, for the immigrants living in France, it still could be and probably is a symbol of racist thought that they feel somewhat oppressed by. And I don't know. It rankles me because I have a hard time pulling it out of the context. I feel like we're commenting on something as Americans that we probably don't really have the background and context to comment on clearly without...
So you mentioned earlier on that you find your own thinking kind of conflicted. Is this getting us to where the conflicts are? Can you just describe what is it in your thinking that's been in motion recently?
I think with me it more has to do with the movement of American advocacy organizations, kind of on this like corporate march. And so there's been a corporatization of human rights advocacy organization. Penn is among those where everything is much more strategic. It's much more just because of funding, you have to have deliverables, you have to have short term targets and goals, and it's kind of it's removing a little bit Penn from the notion of the free and open exchange of ideas and among writers talking about issues of culture and literature that would have an impact, you know, as a broader understanding. I mean, Penn was created in 1921 after World War I as a way to bridge the gap between nations through art and culture so that you could talk about important issues without having around the government, not through the government. Mm-hmm. And I think where we're headed right now is that these organizations, especially in particular Penn, are moving much more, toward the possibility of being more policy oriented or much more diplomatically oriented and less about, bridging those gaps through art and literature and culture and more, not necessarily being the mouthpiece of Western thought, but of Western policy. Uh-huh. And I think that's a slippery slope to be going down. And I don't think it's just Penn that's going through it. I think it's, nonprofit and human rights advocacy organizations across the board. And it's driven by funding. It's driven by, I think there have been a lot of cuts in government spending that have put a lot of people that used to work in government in the State Department in different areas who are now in the nonprofit world because that's where the jobs are.
Right, and they're now scrambling, fighting against each other for the same
the resources.
So is this... is this a relatively recent shift? I mean, is this something that you've seen yourself shifting in the last several years, or is it maybe a longer-term shift that is beginning to accelerate, or how do you understand the landscape?
I'm also the Penn archivist, and so I know, I just received a huge NEH grant to go back and digitize Penn's audio-video archives going back to 1966. And so within that, we see like I don't want to say it's soft power, but art and literature used as a diplomatic tool in the 1960s to really get at the Eastern Bloc. And so there were a lot of dissident writers in the Eastern Bloc who were writing about, who were commenting on, who were criticizing Eastern, the Soviet Union. And Pan American Center and many other organizations were, advocating on their behalf. They're trying to get them out. They're giving them asylum. They're sending them money. They're facilitating communications. They're publishing their work. During this time, Index on Censorship was founded. Penn's Writers in Prison program really came to the forefront at that time. And then under Arthur Miller, you saw a much more stepped up front, engagement with Eastern Bloc writers. I guess what I'm like I always viewed that as not necessarily driven by American diplomacy, and I guess maybe it was age and idealism that maybe kept me from thinking that. And as I get older, and as I see how the mechanisms of the power structures and how organizations work and where things originate and the ultimate goals, I guess I'm beginning to realize that there is much more of a connection between diplomatic power and art and literature, and that there are shared agendas. And I guess what I'm having a hard time grappling with is where I fit into that. As somebody who works for one of the larger human rights advocacy organizations that's based on literature and art.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned surveillance earlier. Yeah. How much of the work that you do, I mean, I kind of mean the daily, the right. kind of just the daily, everyday kind of work that you do in Penn, how much of it has a distinctly kind of post 9/11 feel to it?
So much happened after that. I mean, Penn really, I mean, we had just hired our first professional staff in the 1990s. And then at post 9/11 was when Penn really, really staffed up. And we got a lot of funding to carry out programs. A lot of it was in reaction to the Patriot Act that was passed right after 9/11. It involved a Reader Privacy Act, which was to try and dismantle certain elements of the Patriot Act. One of them was that
the library, right?
It was that they could go into libraries and bookstores and request information on what people had checked out, what people had bought, things that they had viewed. There's also ideological exclusion. You know, there was the case of Tariq Ramadan, who was one of the foremost Islamic scholars. He had we'd invited him to come to the World Voices Festival, and I think he'd also been given a position at Notre Dame, and then the United States denied his visa, so he couldn't actually come, and they decided that there was a connection to it. He'd given money to a terrorist organization. I mean, he ended up getting a visa, but it took, you know, however many years of litigation, of lawsuits to bring it through the process that he... And then I think when Obama was elected, it was one of the first things that he was given a visa, and, you know, the lawsuits were dropped. But there were other things. Surveillance. I mean, this is one of those things... Well, there's journalist privilege. Reporting on Iraq, there was so much misinformation and so much information that wasn't vetted. There was so much information that was manipulated purposely by the government. Reputable journalist organization, New York Times, did not do their job, due diligence of fact-checking and making sure that their sources were cross-referenced. And then the U.S. government went out and it tried, or it tried to target different journalists. James Risen was one of them. When he broke the NSA wiretap story, he was held in contempt of court for however many years. There were a lot of things that really came to the forefront in, you know, the post 9/11 era. A lot of it was domestic, having to do with surveillance, attacks on journalist privilege, ideological exclusion, but also the way we started to do business around the world. I mean, there seemed to be this moment where people were looking at I don't know if it was at America, culture or diplomacy. I don't know what it was, but we seemed to be flexing a certain cultural muscle around the world where we were stepping up our different programs. I mean, it's what coincided at the same time as 9/11 was the rise of China. I mean, China really became a major, you know, international player when the economy opened up. And so with that, you also had one of the most repressive times in China where, you know, there was probably a relative calm after Tiananmen Square for a decade, but really in the early 2000s, they began ramping up a serious censorship machine, and that's when we started seeing many writers, journalists, writers, artists targeted in China. So, I mean, it was a convergence of everything. I mean, I also would have to say that the internet probably had a bigger play than maybe even post 9/11 politics and policy, just because information could be so easily shared now. So we could learn about and vet cases of writers being targeted much more quickly than we ever had in the past. And we knew much more information about them. We also had many more writers who were being targeted for their work online. So Liu Xiaobo's Charter 08, the Chinese government seized his computer, and their whole case hinged on the proliferation of Charter 08 online. Mm-hmm. So it was many different things. Right. It wasn't just post 9/11, although that did play a role in our domestic work, but internationally there's so many other things
at
play.
Convergences, yeah. So I'm curious, what is your view of people like Snowden and the global kind of hacking community, Julian Assange,
right?
The Pirate Party, Anonymous. Is this just a mixed bag? Is it a total evil? Is it total good?
I can't even speak with authority on that because I've only read. I mean, they kind of fall outside of Penn's purview, and I think there many people were disappointed that Penn didn't take up the WikiLeaks case and Julian Assange, that we didn't say more about Snowden. We did convene a symposium in 2013 on surveillance, and so we brought together 50 specialists from around the world to talk about surveillance and the impact that living in a contemporary surveillance state would have on art, culture, and politics. But again, it's such a large and kind of like bottomless abyss topic, and there seems to be so little interest on the public's side, which is shocking. I mean, you know, we could do public programming. We could talk about surveillance and the impact it has, and how, you know, there's data mining, and what's more terrifying about the data mining is really if you think about how the networking capability. I think Dana Boyd wrote some really interesting pieces on this, and it was you know, how you can connect the dots between unintended parties just, you know, through data, and you could pretty much stop dissent if you'd wanted to. You could stop a lot of things just through association. Mm-hmm. And people don't seem to care that they're actually giving the government all this data for free, that when they sign their user agreements for Facebook or for Twitter or for LinkedIn or whatever service they're using, they're basically signing off the ability for those companies to mine their data and to use it for whatever purposes.
Right.
And that the government, I don't think they know or care what pipeline the government has drilled into that, but it's there, and it seems to be, you know, more increasingly better reported, but people don't seem to care about it, which is shocking, and it's very strange. But there's also a sense of helplessness. What can you do about it? What can, as a consumer of information technology, raising millennials are the biggest exhibitionist, you know, generation ever, and do they really care that the data is being mined for them? I don't really know.
Right. I think there's a sense in which we've stopped experiencing ourselves as self-governing, so we have lost our vigilance about what it means to be a self-governing republic.
Yeah. It's a strange place to be, you know, especially living in the United States, where we take so much for granted, mm-hmm. and we're giving away so much. And self-governing, you know, I mean, tied into that, I mean, the digital age is... It presents so much, and it really rips us from, a cultural and historical context in such a way that I feel like, for me, the work that I got in, you know, why I started at Penn, you know, a decade ago or 11 years ago, has changed so dramatically in that time, and it's mostly due to information proliferation. Like, there are things that I don't really know how to wrap my mind around anymore, and some of them are, you know, like the Charlie Hebdo, the responsibility of the cartoonist or the writer or the publishing, you know, body that actually published the cartoons. When things can travel so quickly, where does the responsibility lie? For the misuse or misappropriation or the appropriation of cultural icons or context or artwork. You know, there's the PLOS. I mean, there's so much there's also so much appropriation going on. I don't know.
How significant does the recent, not just the discussion, but the kind of change in momentum of the discussion around the Confederate flag, how important is that?
I think it's, I mean, the discussion itself is extremely important, and also interesting that it's actually taking place. It's heartbreaking that it took a massacre of 9 people to actually bring it to the forefront, But I think, you know, again, and I haven't read up that much on it, but I think it's somewhat heartening that people are actually saying, they're realizing how truly offensive it is to have such a blatant symbol of racism flying over state capitals or integrated so deeply into the cultural norm. And that people of a certain race or color are expected to live with that on a daily basis because another population feels that it's their right and privilege to be able to have that. I think I would hope that the flag is, you know, taken down and that it's not a part of, you know, the South's pride and honor. But again, I can't say that I know or have read or are prepared to talk that much about it because I have my own personal feelings mm-hmm. about it, and I feel like it's a gross negligence to actually continue to have that flag be a symbol and a public symbol that's mm-hmm. part of state governments. I was listening to a piece on NPR today that the governor of Mississippi or somebody in the government of Mississippi was kind of standing by their decision not to... the voters had spoken, that there was a bill or amendment put forth that would remove the flag, you know, from the state flag, and then it was voted down by, you know, a margin of I think three-quarters of the population voted against the amendment to remove it. So they were saying that the voters had spoken. Racist voters had spoken. But, I mean, there are certain moments when the voters, you know, don't really have the moral authority to make decisions like that, which is why, I guess it's a representative democracy, but sometimes representative democracy, you can actually overturn the people's choice, especially when it has that kind of ramification. But again, yeah. the Confederate flag, personally, I think it's one of those things that doesn't seem to me to stand for freedom of expression in any
certainly
sense.
Certainly not. No, it's just been interesting to me. I mean, as a cultural historian, it's been interesting to me to see this intense debate over a symbol, but also an awareness of how powerful symbols actually are. You know, and I think there's probably going to be a really bitter fight over this. I don't think it's going to be a quick and easy victory for the anti-flag side, but it seems to signal something really important about a new level of awareness, or at least the potential for that.
I think there's a shift, and I think it's a positive shift, and I think just the documentation of violence against African Americans or people of color over the last year, an awareness of that, and just the proliferation of it, the YouTube videos, the Facebook posts, the Twitter, the public shaming of people who support that. I mean, there's so much at play and at work in this, and I think it's one of those things where, I don't know if you've read Claudia Rankine's Citizen, but it was a book that really resonated with me, that it presents a perspective that I don't think a lot of white people even realize how privileged they are on a daily basis.
Right,
and we're not privileged to not know.
Yeah, that's
a huge thing. I think maybe, you know, a certain part of the population are beginning to understand that they are, how extensively they are privileged, and that from that position of privilege they can't sit by anymore.
Right.
And so, you know, there's a certain sense of social responsibility, and also a certain sense of awareness. And I think people, I mean, going down to the South, I have relatives in the South, and they still jokingly refer to the Civil War as, what is it, the War of Northern Aggression. And they say this jokingly. You know, they have all their sides and their jokes about the Civil War, and I don't think they, in their wildest dreams, understand how deeply offensive those asides are to a certain population that meant that war was about the, more than just Northern aggression or economics. It was really about breaking down a really awful financial and economic system that depended on free labor, which is still being perpetuated anyway in a completely different way through wages. But they don't see that. So maybe that'll begin to, you know, be broken down. But again, if you think about how long it takes these things to change, so you have one of the things about information and the easy access to information is that we expect instantaneous responses or results from incidents. It takes generations to chisel away at these things and actually bring about cultural change. And so the symbol of the Confederate flag, that's going to take, again, you have to, like the generation that remembers it fondly, they have to kind of die before you can get beyond the fact that it has that resonance.
Right, yeah. Right. And the fact that Roof was 21, that's kind of sobering right there.
Yeah, right. So that's still a generation that's tainted by the Confederate
flag.
Right, I mean,
he was spouting rhetoric from the 1870s, not the 1970s, yeah, the 1870s. You know, so yes, I agree. I mean, all of this is very, very long term.
And I guess that's one of the disappointing things about the current political situation, even the punditry that's going on, is everyone is expecting like these immediate solutions that will, you know, we'll wake up in the morning and there won't be racism or there won't be oppression.
Well, that's, I think, another reading of the flag thing is that, I mean, I, personally, as a cultural historian, I think it's important. Symbols are important. Right. They matter. So I'm not belittling that. On the other hand, there's a part of me that is skeptical that, oh, the flag is actually the easier thing if you feel like you can't affect gun control.
Maybe we can
take the flag down.
It's a compromise, I guess, in that sense. I mean, the gun control, I don't think will be resolved in my kid's lifetime. I mean, that's just, I think it's so deeply embedded into our psyche. Even rational people who I know and respect, they still stand strong, firm with the right to bear arms.
Yeah. So, I'm curious about your own writing. You alluded to it earlier, but all of this thinking that you've been doing around these issues, has it changed your own relationship to your own work?
I think, my work at Penn has not resonated. I would say the people that I've met through Penn, so the writers, whether it's having a conversation with Edward Albee or meeting Claudia Rankine or being able to talk to, a poet from Syria, it's affected my sense of narrative and also maybe made me less inhibited as a writer, but I think probably what's been more impactful on my own writing is just being a parent. I mean, most of what I write about has transitioned to being nonfiction, and it's reconciling, I deal with bigger issues at Penn. My writing is deeply personal and reconciling, my own childhood and my own upbringing completely off topic by a mother who was completely checked out. So it's and my own duties as a parent. So they're not political, they're not, advocacy related. It's deeply, it's on a completely different level. But I think what I've learned is how to tell those stories from a different perspective, or how to, use imagination and narrative devices, to a different effect. And really maybe more responsibility to different audiences. And it's, the writing that I do is mostly geared toward, I have adopted children, so it's geared toward trying to, shine light, not on, not trying to impact other adoptive families, but people who don't, again, who take for granted on a daily basis being parents or raising kids that don't have to, deal with issues of identity or transracial identity or, multiculturalism. So it's similar but very different.
Well, I know that you have a lot going on today and you're on a tight schedule. I really appreciate your taking the time. Is there anything that we didn't talk about or that you didn't get a chance to say that you feel should be out there in the world?
No. Probably, I've already probably said way too much at the beginning about my hesitations about, advocacy work or the direction we're going in.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right.